the others have all been mental. I was not in the right spot. And in hindsight, I think I could have worked through them better. And so I had to go through that process of feeling that pain of DNFing when I shouldn't have, to really start to build up the mental strength to get to a point where I could work through that more effectively.
You're listening to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, and this is Trail Talk, where we have casual conversations with all kinds of runners. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultra runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation will go. So if you're ready, let's get started. Hey, welcome back to the show, the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. Today, I have a returning guest, Todd Chandler. Last time we talked with him, he was recovering from an injury. If I remember right, we called it ultra couching is what we had said. And so I know that the injury, I think, took him a while to come back. And so he's back. He did something fairly epic, and I got to be in on just the end of it. I didn't even know he was doing it until I ran into him on the trail. He did a 100K trail run by himself, and we'll get into the details of that in a little bit. So Todd, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thank you, Eric. It's good to be back.
So if people didn't hear your previous episode, give us a kind of a short thing about your running, how you got started running, kind of what you do as a runner.
I think you and I have similar pathways to running, in that we didn't come to it till later in life. And I'd say I'd been a very active trail runner and ultra runner for about the last 5 to 6 years. I did run my very first marathon back in 1995. Prior to that, I was running commuting to work. I was running and biking into work, but I'd never gone further than 3 miles. And a buddy said he was going to go up and do the Chicago Marathon. And I said, well, that sounds fun. So my very first race was a marathon.
Okay.
And I did that. And then 10 years went by before I did any other races. It was such a miserable experience.
So were you running during that 10 years as well? Or was there a time you stopped running?
Yeah, off and on. And then really, I kind of started to pick it back up. And it was about 10 years ago here in Kansas City, a friend of mine, got me to run a Bruise and Blues 10-mile race. And so I trained up for that and I ran that. And then I ran the Kansas City Half Marathon. Mm-hmm. At that point, I had done 3 marathons. And, you know, in those city marathons, when you hit a point and the half marathon people go one direction and the full marathon people go another direction, mm-hmm. I had never experienced going the lesser direction. And when I was running the half marathon that year and I went, I had a bit of pang of regret of not going the full distance. Mm-hmm. So that got me back into running marathon distances. And when I started doing that, I started wanting to do the 50 and 50 states. And a friend of mine wanted to do Pikes Peak Marathon. So we started training and he got me into running trails. And then I was like, holy cow, this is a whole different style of running. I love this so much more than running on the roads.
Yes. Yeah. And for most of us who are running trails, it's like, yeah, it's a lot easier on the body, and there's a lot of differences for trail running. So yeah, well, cool. And I know you've done a couple of hundreds. You've done a lot of distances we talked about last time. And well, tell us about coming back from your injury. You were injured for quite a while, and I think the last time we talked, you were still, had a ways to go before you got recovered. So how did your recovery go?
Now that I'm through my recovery, I will say great. In the midst of the recovery, it felt like it was going way too slow. When I first became a parent, somebody gave me advice and they said, when your child starts crying, look at the clock. Because the crying always feels like it takes much longer than it actually does. So like, even if they're crying for like 17 minutes. That feels like forever, but it's like, mm-hmm. It's just 17 minutes. And I think coming through this recovery, now that I'm on the backside of it, I probably should have looked at the clock, because while it felt like forever in the moment, 4 months in the grand scheme of running and what I plan to do and to make this is a lifestyle for me, it was really worth it. I did a ton of strength training during that time. I was in a boot for about 2 months. And, you know, just as I started ramping back up and I started feeling good and ramped back up and then had another issue and immediately had to take some more time off and got in some physical therapy at that point. And, you know, since then been doing pretty good and had a good progression back.
Yeah. And I know you and I run together and I follow you on Strava and there were, you know, times I kept thinking, you know, I saw you coming back and I went, wow, you've been off for a lot longer than what I thought you were going to be. And so that was it. That must have been it. I didn't realize that you had re-injured yourself. And that's common for a lot of distance runners, runners in general, is we think we're good and we go out and it's easy to get re-injured.
Well, it felt great while I was running. It was, you know, kind of 2 days after that run that I really felt like, oh no, this isn't working right. And the injury was bursitis in my foot. And then I had two stress reactions in my foot and those were much sharper. Stress reactions have healed up nicely, but I still have consistent bursitis and dealing with that. And so that's an ongoing issue to try to figure out how do I find the right shoes for that? How do I adjust to that?
So that's something that you're still trying to work through. And I mean, I'm not familiar with what bursitis is, but it sounds like it's an ongoing thing that kind of is there if you don't do things right.
Yep, that's exactly right. So it's basically just a swelling of the bursa, which is the fluid sacs kind of around where the muscle and the bones come together. And so I know it's a podcast. I keep holding my hand up. It's right on the ball of my foot, kind of between my third and fourth toe on my left foot. There's just a constant tenderness there. And if I overdo it a little bit, you know, I'll get some swelling there and just kind of managing that.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed you've got your mileage. I mean, you started off with just a few miles and then now you're doing some rather longer miles, but, we're going to talk about your 100K in a bit. So did it bother you during the 100K?
It did not. I actually felt really great during the 100K. I've over the past year, I've started to refer to it as awareness of the pain and hurt. So kind of three phases of it. And I would say I always have awareness and okay. It may just be a simpleness of kind of, I can always feel it or know it's there, but it never moved into that pain stage, which felt really good.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, one of the reason for this podcast, the reason I asked you to come back is that, I was going in a Saturday run. I kind of got a late start, later than I normally did, and ran through a trail. And one of our mutual friends, Gilbert, was standing there and said, "Hey, Todd's doing 100K on the Shouse Loop." And I went, "What?" And it's like, and he said, "Yeah, and there's what they call the farthest known record, farthest known distance, within our running group of the most loops done, and that you were on your loop to break the record when I got there." And so I said, "Oh, I got to stick around and see this." And so, but then you went on to do and finish 100K. So to set this up, tell us what the Shouse Loop is like for people who are not from Kansas City.
Sure. The Shouse Loop is what the mountain bikers call a pump track, which means it's not a lot of elevation, but it's got some bunny hills on it and a little bit of elevation. It's a 0.294 mile loop, so just slightly over a quarter of a mile. And we've used it for an event that one of our local runners has created called Shoustus, which is a timed running event that we do close to the winter solstice and close to the summer solstice. And for the winter solstice, we run from sunrise to sunset, so the shortest day of the year. We run the whole time. And this is a chance for people to run that loop as many times as possible. And so the record is the most known loops. And then during summer, we coordinate that around the time when the park is open up overnight, and it's from sunset to sunrise. So the shortest night of the year we run. And up until I broke the record, the most known loops was 196, and it was 58 miles. And I've always had a dream of doing 100 miles on Shouse.
I know we talked about that a few years ago, and then it ended up, and we were going to do it in the wintertime, if I remember right.
Right. And there's just a lot of logistical issues with that. And as I was training back and didn't really see a race that I wanted to do yet and wanted to push my distance, but not quite ready for 100 milers, I thought, well, I'm going to go out there and just see if I can break the record. 212 loops is 100K. So, you know, kind of getting that 58 miles mm-hmm. up to 62 miles seemed like a doable distance. And just in case I couldn't do it, I didn't tell too many people I was out there doing it. The weather broke nicely for me. I had a few friends doing it. And then Gilbert didn't know either. So when he showed up and all you guys were there to see the record broken, that was very motivating for me.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun to see you do that. And then the park is officially closed overnight. And so hopefully the park service is not a subscriber to the podcast and come knocking on your door. But so you started in the evening and ran overnight.
Yeah. So hopefully nobody from the park service is listening to this. Please don't pass it along to them. I certainly wanted to be as respectful and, follow the spirit of everything that would go on during that. But I started about 7:40 at night and took a cooler and my Home Depot bucket, which has got a lot of runner supplies in it, would be a place for me to sit down, and a box full of food and supplies that I needed out to Shouse. And we should say Shouse is a portmanteau for an old toilet house, shower house out there, and that they've combined those together to take the two words and put it together. Shouse.
S-house.
S-house. And it is, so there are, but there's no roof on it. It's dilapidated. So there's just walls and a few broken toilets out there. And so on the back side of that, I'd kind of set up camp to be able to run through and grab my supplies. And it was amazingly peaceful. And you know, it's close to a lake, so you could hear all the boats out there. And the park closes at midnight, and so you could hear the park ranger come through and do the big whoop whoop kind of as the closing sound. And about 1 o'clock, it was deadly quiet out there.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your mindset for. I mean, you're running just a little over a quarter mile loop. And so some people would say that alone would be like hell on earth, but you were running it overnight and by yourself. What was it like to keep going? And what were some of the things you did to keep yourself moving? Cause I'd imagine that would be a mental strain than really physical. There's not a level of elevation.
So one of the things I love about what you've done with the ultramarathon mindset is really attacking the mental side of the game. And I feel like I started out at kind of a decent level there, but really trying to take things to the next level. That's what was part of appealing to me about this challenge. I've completed two official 100-mile races, and I've done one self-supported 100-mile run. And I got impressed last year at the Ozark Trails 100. I went down and filmed that, and I got to just see a lot of runners in action. The previous 100-mile races that I've done, I take a big crew, like three people minimum. Mm-hmm. So I've got crew and pacers, and I've got all my it's nice to be able to have the friends to be able to come into a crew station and see that you know that from your 100-miler.
Yeah.
And it's a team sport. Like it's really challenging going down to see OT. I was amazed how many people just run it by themselves. There's no crew, no pacers. They run through the night by themselves. And I was really impressed by the mindset it takes to be able to do that. And I said, well, how do I start to develop that mental strength to be able to pull that off, to be more self resilient, more self-reliant. And so that was kind of the ultimate goal. That's part of why I wanted to run through the night. Part of it was just, I think it was going to take me longer than the park's open from 6 to midnight. Running from 6 to midnight, it took me 18 and a half hours. That's 18 hours. That would have been kind of really close to be able to do that. So I wanted to kind of be in there in the safe zone. And so all that to say, I made sure I was prepped and well rested. I had everything that I needed. I find the loops to be somewhat meditative after a while, that you, that's not monotony, but kind of just kind of be able to focus in on some other things. I switched direction every 20 loops. So I had a grid paper to count the loops, because I wasn't going to rely on my watch to tell me how far I had gone. So I hand counted every one of the loops, and I had specific things like after 10 miles or 10 loops, I was going to eat something. And so just kind of having those little benchmarks of like, okay, in two more loops, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take that. I managed to make it till about 4 a.m. before I got out my music and started listening to music. And really, I mean, by 5, the birds started singing and it was beautiful. And once I heard that, I turned my music off and just really enjoyed the sunrise. Then 7:30-ish, Leia and Colleen, my coaches, who have been fantastic on helping me rebuild from my injury, showed up and started running with me. And then Gilbert and Paul came through. And man, that just, the fact that somebody knew what I was doing out there and was kind of excited about it was exciting. Then I was getting really close to the record, and you and Paul and Mark and Gilbert were all there. And that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's something that I've found about the running community, is that almost always you can run out on the trail. You will run into somebody that you know. It's not every time, but it's not unusual. In fact, it was this winter. I think it was like 6 degrees out, and I thought nobody's going to be out here, and I ran into David on the trail, and like he was the only other one out there, but. There were a couple of mountain bikers too, I think, but yeah, it was snowy and, but yeah, that's that. I like that about where we're at, is that we tend to run into each other.
Yeah. Sometimes just at the Wyandotte County Lake, where we run out there a lot, there's kind of a consistent, the main 10 mile loop. A lot of people run it counterclockwise. If I get out there late sometime, I like to run it clockwise just so I can run into more people, because I don't out there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have started running it clockwise just because I like the west side of the lake better than the east side. And so
that's very fair. Yeah, that's a hard choice.
Sometimes I'll do an out and back, because it's like, okay, I'll just stay on this side of the lake.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, and also the hills are more, I was going for hill training. And so the hills, there's bigger hills on the west side. So
yeah,
it's kind of where I stayed. But
I did have one more mindset thing that helped me through the night. I made friends with two spiders. The spiders, when you're running at night, I love the way their eyes twinkle through the woods. And in particular, I had one going each direction. There was just a big spider that was consistently in one spot. And so every time I come around the corner, I'd see their eyes light up at me. And in particular one, he'd see me and then he'd run into his hole. And then he'd come back out and be ready the next time I came through. So, hey, buddy, how you doing?
Yeah, well, I've seen the spiders in the fall, but a lot of times I don't get out and run at night during the summertime. It wasn't, I guess they are, warm weather creatures, and so they would come out now. They're wolf spiders, which ground, they stay on the ground. They don't not I don't I don't think they get up in trees. They don't if they do webs, it's not something you run into. So,
sure.
But my first encounter with wolf spiders, I was running the Hawk 100, and it was at night, and I saw, and it was a wet year, and I thought it was just dew reflecting on the hot. And then I realized that, these are spider eyes, and they were thousands of them.
It can be a little overwhelming when you start to see that.
Yeah. When I realized what it was, I was like, oh, wow. Then I was like, oh, wait a minute. No, they're not bothering me. That's really cool.
Yeah. The first time I saw them was running Free State out at Lake Perry and running through the night. And I was running with Ashley Mullins, and she's like, those are spider eyes. And I'm like, what? Yeah.
One thing I found out about that as well is that you can't see them unless your headlamp is on your forehead.
Oh, sure.
There's something about the angle of the light If you're just holding a flashlight, walking through wood, through the woods, you'll never see the spider eyes. It has to be, the light has to come straight above about where your eyes are to get the right angle.
That makes sense, because I'm sure the reflective part that you're hitting back is such a small aperture, such a small target, that if it was just a slight angle variation, you wouldn't see it.
Yeah, so now I wear a waist light, and so it's I don't get to see that.
What waist light do you wear?
I wear the Kogala.
Yeah. You like it?
I like it. Their mounting system leaves a lot to be desired. They've got a magnetic plate. And so I've tried to like attach it to a belt, and it's hard to get it secure. I've ended up just putting the magnetic plate inside my shirt and just clipping it, clipping the light on the outside. But as far as the way it works, it's a great light, lots of brightness. And I like the light down there for being able to see the trail, see what the texture of the trail is a lot more,
three-dimensional.
A lot more three-dimensional than when there's wearing a headlamp, it tends to flatten out all of the rocks. And so you adapt to it as a runner, or you trip, but the waist light makes it just a little bit. I know people who run with both.
I like to run with a flashlight and a headlamp for that depth perception. I think it helps a lot. And I have a waist light. I have the Ultra Spire. It just bounces too much for me. I can't figure out the right place to hold it in. And the Kogala, that I've heard the magnetic stuff and the battery pack is kind of heavy. And I'm like,
the battery pack is heavy. I mean, I got one that, it'll last about 6 hours on high. It's pretty heavy, and I got two of them.
Yeah.
I can go all night with with the two batteries, but it's heavy. And the other thing about the waist light is, when your arms are swinging, it creates shadows in your peripheral vision, and you have to kind of get over that. It was distracting for me the first time I ran with it. I was like, oh, but it finally got used to it.
Do you know Stuart Johnson?
No, I don't.
Stuart and Deb Johnson, they run a lot with the Trailhawks, and they've done a ton of things. But Stuart's a little bit of a local legend, and the Superior 100, he goes up, and he's done that every year. So I think it's 22 years. This year will be 23 years for him, which would be just fascinating. He's one of the race directors for OT 100.
Oh, okay.
He and Paul. But I was running Nighthawk with him one year, and he was behind me, and he had a waist lamp, and they're so much brighter. And so it was just kind of lighting up the sides of me as we were going along. And he tripped and went off into the woods, rolled off into the woods. And it was just weird to see the light spin and twirl around me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They put out a lot of light.
Yeah. It's almost kind of like that scene in Psycho where the light gets hit and the light flies flashing in all different ways.
Yeah. So you, how did you feel? I mean, as far physically, what were some of the things that you did and your fueling for running 100K on your own?
I should have got my tracking sheet for this. So I did a fairly elaborate tracking sheet.
Yes, yeah. I know. I saw that, and I looked at it and was like, it looked like some sort of code that you were working on.
Are you familiar with Jim Collins, author of Good to Great?
Oh, vague. Not. I wouldn't say familiar. I've recognized the name. Yeah.
Sure. He's a management consultant, leader, thought leader that I have just admired and followed for many, many years. And he has a tracking system for how productive he is within a given day. So every day he gives himself a grade, and it's a -2 to a 2. So 0 is meh, 1 is good, 2 is great, -1 is negative, and -2 is just horrible.
Okay.
And so I marked all 212 laps on a -2 to a 2 scale. And I had a lot of ones and twos. I had a great run. I got it. I had like two -1s and like five or six zeros. The rest were all ones and twos.
Wow.
And the kind of the low patch that I hit was probably two-ish. And I had a sandwich, I had a ginger ale, and then I just walked a loop with my coffee thermos. And, you know, that's the other beauty of doing such a small loop is like when I'd hit 10 and it was time to eat, I'd take a sandwich and I'd just walk a loop. You know, it's nothing. The next aid station is only a quarter of a mile away.
Right. And it wasn't like you'd have to figure out what to do with it, you know, and carry the wrapper or whatever for 5 miles or a half eaten sandwich. If you didn't, I mean, there are times in.
Right. Right. You know, I could just drop the half eaten sandwich back in the box and continue on my journey. So that part of it worked great.
Yeah.
Have you done any timed races like a 6 hour or a 12 hour race?
I have not. I did the Shoustis. I think it was this year.
Okay.
And that was Shoustis, my first, and it was a looped, you know, it was the same course. It was a looped race. There were a lot of things that, slowed me. One of the things I noticed is that having an aid station every quarter mile eats up a lot of time.
Oh yeah.
That was the first timed race I've done. And I was thinking that I would get in, you know, with 9 hours. I was like, oh, I could get in a 50K. Yeah. And I think I made 28 miles. So I was like, well, yeah, I spent time sitting in the aid station for a lot longer.
That's a great call out. And, you know, it took me 18 and a half hours to do it, which is a really slow 100K. And I think I probably walked more laps because of the shortness of it. And even on the laps where all I did was mark my lap, I didn't grab any food. I didn't grab any extra water. You know, just doing that took time every time. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Cause you had to stop and kind of think. And so you would end up with 15, 20 seconds, you know, right. At least. Yeah.
Right. It was kind of funny. About 9 o'clock, a teenage couple had showed up there. I think Shoust is because it kind of feels like a little bit of a building, or the Shoust feels a little bit like a building that, you know, it can be kind of a place to hang out for teenagers or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I came up to him and I'm like, are you guys planning on hanging out for a while? Oh, we're just out hiking and such. And I said, well, I'm running loops right around here, so I'm going to be by about every 3 to 4 minutes. Like, oh, okay.
Give them a warning. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I was kind of concerned, like all my stuff was right there. So I just wanted to let them know I'm going to be right back.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They were super nice and friendly.
Yeah. And, the thing about the loop course that, besides the monotony of it is that you just can get distracted.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a loop race, which is, at the Dark and Dirty, and it's a 50K and it's a 5K, lap.
Okay.
So every 3 miles, you know, the nice thing is you don't have to carry much, you know, I can just carry a water bottle. And it's an overnight, but, you know, I was thinking, wow, you know, if I hit an aid station every 3 miles, I just really need to be cognizant of that. When any ultra, I know that, you know, the Hawk 100, I had quite a bit of time in the aid station several times. And, it's just, you know, one of those things. It's like, had stuff I had to take care of. It wasn't like I could skip it, but, you know, there was a porta potty there. I was like, yes, I need to make use of this because I don't want to have to go in the woods. That's a big part of running ultras.
I am, you know, I cannot support, or recommend anybody running a beer mile, but to me, it's so metaphorical for the other races because it's the chugging time of getting the beer down that makes the difference as to who wins and who loses within the beer mile. And I think for me, you know, we're certainly backpackers. We're not backpackers in the sense of carrying a backpack, but we're back of the packers and running these longer races to make progress or to keep moving forward. It's the aid station streamlining and efficiency that makes a huge difference. If we could slow down less, then I think we continue to improve our performance and do better.
Yeah. Yeah. I started going through my, I'm signed up for the Hawk 100.
Nice.
This year. Well, it was deferred from last year. I signed up for last year and deferred. It was like, okay. So I got my spreadsheet out and, you know, kind of the distance between the aid stations, what I'm estimating my pace to be. And then also I'm putting in the time that I plan on spending each stop for each loop at each aid station. Okay. I'm going to allow myself 3 minutes for this because I'm going to grab food, grab water and get out.
Yep.
Places where I see my crew, you know, I'm going to spend 6 minutes and then, you know, so I charted that out. So, I'm not usually a planner. I'm kind of more like, oh, let's go out and see what happens. A friend of mine, Chablis, was my first 100. She says, I want to know when you're going to be at the aid station. You know, she's a planner. And she kind of forced me to do this for the first time. I was like, this is really a pretty good idea. Sure. And so, I have those. So when I come into I give it to my crew and say, here, this is my plan. So when I come into the aid station, on this loop, this is about how long I want to be here. And if I'm here longer, throw me out.
Right. When running Vermont, Keith Krieger was on my crew and he was just fantastic. I was like never longer than 5 minutes in the aid station. And, you know, he'd literally start the clock and, you know, be like, you're coming up on 4 minutes. Let's get going. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And if your crew knows what you need, you know, they can take your pack and pack it and get you in and out fairly quickly. That's the advantage of having a crew versus, you know, you were talking about the people who do it by themselves. When you're having to dig through your, you know, drop bag and, you know, take care of yourself, you have to allow that extra time.
Yeah, no, totally. And I ran Black Canyon 100K 2, 3, maybe 4 years ago. I hit a really dark spot. I got a little dehydrated. And I mean, just the recovery of like getting I spent 40 minutes in an aid station because I had to take the time to get fluids back in and start feeling better again. And that's really tough to do by yourself. You know, having a crew kind of help speed that along makes a difference.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, talking about the mental aspect of things, besides the physical, what did you do to kind of get yourself through that rough patch?
Yeah, I've had two really dark patches that I recovered from. I've had DNFs where I didn't recover from. But Black Canyon was one of them. And it was poor planning on my part that I thought I could get from one aid station to the other. And I didn't have a lot of desert running experience. And I just didn't take enough water from one aid station. I didn't top off like I should have. And I ran out of water before getting to the next aid station. And I was really starting to feel the dehydrated. I hit an aid station. I sat down and I refilled and I could tell what it was. I actually stopped another runner before I got to the aid station. I said, do you have any water you can spare? Cause I just like, I need some. And they gave me a little, and then I got to the aid station and I chugged a bunch. I didn't have my bladder with me. I only had a handheld. I think that was what the problem was. I filled up best I could and then got out of that. But it wasn't until I got to the next aid station that I had my bag there and I could take 40 minutes and sit down. I changed my shoes. I sat, I put some ice on my head. And what was nice was I didn't really have an option to drop at that point. Like I was like, I can't get out of here. The tough part was it was a qualifying race for me.
Okay.
I had to get a certain time to get into Vermont. And so I was just watching the clock just tick away that I wasn't going to be able to hit that time. And, but I taking care of myself, I got back out. It was one of the strongest finishes for a race I ever had. In fact, I hit the last aid station. It was like 3.5 miles to the finish line and had like, I can't remember how much time I had left beforehand, but they're like, all right, 3.5 miles. And I'm like, is it 3.5 or are you just being nice? Like, yeah. I'm like, no, like it's a legit
wheel. Sometimes you can't believe.
Right. And I was like, are you serious? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, if I get out of here and get going, I can actually make the cutoff. And it like for the qualifying. Mm-hmm. And I did. I got it like within 3 minutes to spare. And so mentally that was just kind of a nice thing of like when I was like, okay, just let that go and focus on your health, then that helped me.
Yeah, because if you'd have held on to that regret or the or the projected regret. I mean, that's it's like life. It's not, you know, it's the fear of what we think might happen.
Right.
And you project the worst case scenario onto things, and it that really interferes with your ability to cope with the things you really need to do.
Yeah.
So mentally, did you let that go? He's like, okay, you know, if I'm.
Yeah. I said, no, it's all right. Just let's get to the finish and let's just have some fun. And it's a very fun race. It's Aravaipa running, and I think they just do a fantastic job. And it was wonderful. And so once I did that and I started feeling better and I ran when I could, and then gradually I could start running more and more and more, and just kind of kept pushing. And then when that goal came back in alignment that I could still make it, that's when I really kicked it in.
Yeah. That doesn't always work out that way, but, it's always great when it does.
No, but I think mentally I was at a point that if it hadn't, I would have been fine. It was, mm-hmm. Okay, what can you do to just have fun and enjoy your time out here?
Well, and I think for any ultra runner, I mean, when you have a DNF, I mean, all of us have had some sort of a DNF that it's not like you want that to happen, but you kind of have to go into a race going like, well, if I don't make it, I need to make sure that I come out on the other side and I'm okay with what I've done.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing, and this goes back into the mindset, is that you don't want to have a DNF and the next day say, you know, I really could have done it. Mm-hmm. And that, so do you have a good sense when you've been in those places of what your body needs and kind of where your body's at, you know, what were the times when you said, yeah, I really have to DNF, and what was the difference between that and saying, you know, I think I can keep going?
I'm an extremely cautious runner, and I think I run with a lot of people that would probably say, yeah, he's a little bit of a baby. I'm not a person that runs through pain. I'm not a person that keeps pushing. I think that helped in the injury I had this last year, that we caught it early before I did any serious damage and was able to recover. Having said that, out of my four or five DNFs, I'd have to go back and count them up, I've only had one that physically the DNF was the right call. The others have all been mental. I was not in the right spot. And in hindsight, I think I could have worked through them better. And so I had to go through that process of feeling that pain of DNF and when I shouldn't have, mm-hmm. To really start to build up the mental strength to get to a point where I could work through that more effectively. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say they haunt me, but I've learned from them and certainly feel like I've got more mental strength to get through them now than what I had in the past. The Nighthawk, which is a 50K that starts at 8 p.m. Locally, that was one where my electrolytes got really low and I was miserable. And I happened to be running with Yvonne, who is she's a director of an OR nurse. So she's, you couldn't have been with somebody better. And she just diagnosed my problem and was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get to Land's End, the aid station, and we're going to get you a gel. We're going to get this and we're going to get that. I sat down, I took a nap. It's a 50K and I took a nap, things started to come back into alignment and then had a nice strong finish. And that's been my process since the DNFs that I've had, is to just give myself more time, just to say, this is really going to heal. And if it's not a broken bone, it's not blood coming out or whatever. It's really, and there are legit things that I see runners run through that I'm like, it's not worth it. Like, don't do that. But if it's just because of nutrition, if it's because of exhaustion, if it's because of hydration, those are all things that time can help you solve and to keep moving.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think.
Yeah. And I'm sorry for.
No, go ahead.
But I haven't yet DNF'd by timing out, which to me is that like I need to be like, give yourself more time. If you run out of clock, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But don't make the call yourself yet at this point. And so that's where I'm still working on my mental strength to be able to better handle that. And that's part of why I wanted to do this challenge was it was kind of a nice thing to really kind of push myself, because all I had out there overnight was me to just keep myself going.
Yeah. And I think I know two people who have had stress fractures in a race and finished the race. Yeah. I think, you know, one, I mean, one of them is Barrett. I mean, and another one is Abby, the gal that I paced her. She's from Oklahoma. And she told me of a race that she did like 6 miles or more with the, you know, stress fracture. And I'm like, yeah, that's quite a bit more, but you know, there are pains you can work through. I mean, I had a pain in the pumpkin holler. At about 58 miles, and it felt like somebody stuck a knife in the top of my foot. And
it's really tough to tell, is this a pain that's causing me more damage if I keep going, or is this something I can work through or not?
Yeah. I ended up trying to, you know, working through it. I ended up walking for the rest of the, I couldn't run. I mean, anytime I ran it would hurt, but it was there 3 months and I still had that soreness. It didn't affect my ability to run. It was just sore. And so it was like, yeah, but I think I made the right choice. And so yeah. I'm fine with that, but yeah, that's something I think it's hard to judge where your body's at, especially when you're that far into a race. Yeah. And what you're talking about, give it time. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
So do you have any big plans for future races coming up? Do you have any big plans? And then I'm going to ask, do you have a bucket list race? Something you haven't done and you want to do?
So they're actually, I guess, closely related. So, since I've started doing this, Western States is just that ultimate bucket list.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And do you know Marvin Maston?
No, I don't.
So he's, have you run Winter Psycho, where there's been a drummer up at the top of the Third Sister?
I have not run Winters. I have always volunteered to help at an aid station. So I've been at the dam. I heard the drummers, but that's, and I've seen pictures of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Marvin is the drummer.
They dress in kilts and set up the drums in the middle of the woods and drum.
Right. And Marvin ran Western States, and he's our age, and it took him 8 years to get into Western States. And so it's been one of those ones that I'm just like, I'm going to run a Western States qualifier every year, just so that someday hopefully it will happen. And so I have two under my belt, and last year they waived it. And they've waived the, where they have to be consistently year to year now. You still just get to accumulate them and add them up. Because each time you do another qualifier, you double the number of lottery tickets you get.
Oh, okay. I didn't. So if you run a Western States qualifier every year, then if you do it 3 years in a row, you would get 3 slots in the lottery. Is that what they say?
You'd get 4. So you get 1 your first year, you get 2 the second, then you get 4, then you get 8, then you get 16.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it doubles every year that you do it, so that by the time you get to 8 years, you got a
fairly better shot than better than average. Yeah.
Right. Than the person who's doing it the first year. Hmm. So having said that, I did not have a Western States qualifier on. I took COVID very cautiously and I was recovering from my thing. So I haven't done a race. I don't know the last race I've done. Holy cow, it's been well over a year. So I just, before running this 100K, I started looking at 100 milers or qualifiers, because some of them are 100Ks and they qualify. Mm-hmm. And 189 qualifying races for Western States.
Oh, it runs, goodness.
November to November. So we're already halfway through the year. So that's half of them gone. Mm-hmm. Many of them are international. I don't have the time or money saved up right now to do an international race. So those are all gone. I'm crewing Barrett at Kettle Moraine. So I'm crewing friends at Kettle Moraine, at Big Horn, and at Leadville. I have a great Grand Canyon trip planned in October. And so I've got big chunks of time already blocked out. Take all those races away. That left me about 11 races. And the Hawk, which I'm excited about you running that. It's the 10th anniversary for it. But
I didn't know that. That's cool.
But I'm on the board of the Trailhawks, so I'm going to be around for that. So that race, that weekend's also blocked out. And so all of that tied in, there was 11 races. So 189 down to 11. Then you start going through and which ones still have spots available. And then it's down to two.
Oh my. So
there were only two races available. Burning River, which Jerry Hollis ran 2 years ago. And Pinhoti, which is like the first weekend in November. And so having such a successful 100K, I went ahead and signed up for Burning River. And
okay.
I try to run it old school is what I've been calling it. No crew, no pacers.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
So,
yeah. Yeah. If I remember, was that in Illinois?
It's in Ohio.
Ohio. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, other bucket list wise, I'd really want to go beyond 100 miles. I want to add sleep to the equation and figure out how to get into that. So I signed up for a 200-mile race in 2020. So it's in April. It's, and it's a 10-mile loop that you run 20 times. So it's this consistent. Wow, so okay. That's part of the mental training of what I wanted to do is could I do that? It's a loop very similar to the Wyandotte County Lake loop that we have here. It's Pottawatomie and it's in Illinois.
Okay.
You said
2020 is that was last year.
Yes.
Okay.
It got canceled because COVID was breaking out just at that time. So it's first week in April. So kind of March was when things were shutting down and they shut that down. And I was trained and ready for that. Then I got deferred to this year. They limited the crew to just one person and I was still kind of recovering from where it was. So I deferred it for one more year.
Okay.
So,
you got a 200 mile coming up next year.
In April of 2021. Yeah.
Okay.
Or 2022.
Yeah. 2022.
And it'll be the third year I've essentially been signed up for this race.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
There's speaking of over 100 miles, the new race, I saw a lot of it on Instagram, Cocodona 250 in Arizona. I was like, that looked like a fun race. And they give you
it's five days, isn't it? For that
5 days. Yeah. Yeah. So for the distance, it's a pretty generous cutoff time.
Yeah.
Because I know some of the 200 plus mile races I've seen, they're doable, but it's like, if you're not a fast runner, if you can't put in a lot of miles, even so, it'd be, on the borderline. I know we have a mutual friend, Misty, who has a goal to run Moab 240.
Yeah.
And I think she can do it, but 5 days is a pretty generous cutoff for a 250 mile race. And so that's one of those things that I've looked at. I was like, I might consider doing that.
Yeah, Pottawatomie is 72 hours, so it's tight. That's a big concern as I've been training for it, is how do I get that done? And Peter had signed up for that with me as well. And we went out and did a preview run of the course last year, so March of 2020. And it was first part of March. And we got a chance to run with the race director. And he said, it's the sleep that kills people. They go to sleep and sleep too long
Yeah. And, from what I've heard, that's the strat. You have to, besides hydration and fuel, you have to factor in a sleep plan as well.
Yeah.
Something that would be a good challenge to take on.
I'm a pretty good napper. I think napping is a superpower of mine. So this, I think, is a bit of my strength.
Yeah. And I've never tried. I mean, the running overnight, it was a new experience to me. And so I wasn't sure how that would go. And so that works fine, but thinking of having to run 16, 18, 20 hours and then sleep for four and get up and do that day after day. I could see how that would be a different, whole different ball game.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And I just feel like the more nighttime running I can do, the better off. Scott, and I, a mutual friend of ours, literally last night ran out of Wyandotte County. So we started about 4:30 and ran till about 10. And, it was, you know, it's just good to get that, those dark hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's something about, you know, seeing the sunset and, you know, all the woods get dark and,
yep.
I love that time. Even before I was as a kid, I mean, my dad and I would go out and we were out hunting and, you know, it was wintertime and got dark and we could hear the coyotes howling off in the distance. And I mean, I always loved that, but, getting back into running, you know, kind of brought some of those memories back for me when I've, you know, been out there and times that I've been out just on my own in the trail and just that time of night is, it's just a cool feeling.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, hey, thank you for doing this, being back on the show again, and some of the things that you talked about with mindset, that really is a pretty good way to build up a stronger mindset is to be out there by yourself and have to just rely on
it's immersion training.
If you're,
you know, that was the beauty of doing it when the park was technically closed was I was locked in. I couldn't leave. So.
Yeah, there is that. Well, I mean, yeah, if you did have the option of going to sleep. And so I guess the other thing I was at, where did you put your truck? I mean, did they not see that the truck was, you know, that there was somebody parked there or?
No, they saw it. And I had known enough friends who had to leave their cars there overnight, either because they had drank too much or there was mechanical issues, that it was never a problem, that I thought that would be fine. And it was. And so I parked near the trailhead. And I do think they kind of, based on where I could hear the whoop whoops of the siren, I do think they were kind of at the truck and checking it out. But.
And one of the other things I thought about is, did they patrol it? Did they lock it down and not patrol it?
Yeah.
At night. So there wasn't any risk of them seeing your light bobbing through the trees and coming out to figure out what was going on.
I would say there was a risk of it. and again, like a beer mile, I wouldn't recommend it for anybody. I probably will not do it again. And I was nervous, out there about it, but Shouse is located far enough into the woods and it's, spring has been lush enough that I thought the likelihood of them seeing the light bobbing up and down in the woods was very low.
Yeah. And that's, I know I've heard of other people in other parts of the country doing similar things. And, you know, there's a term that they call for, you know, that's termed, you know, staying at the park over after hours when it's, right. When it's closed. But yeah, it's, I'm sure that they would have had words for you if they'd have found you, but
I was fortunate enough that I tried sleeping up at the trailhead up at Smithville, which I honestly didn't know that wasn't allowed. And so I was awoken at like 2-ish in the morning by a police officer and told that I couldn't be there and I had to leave. And I thought, well, the beauty of this is the worst thing they're going to do is say, I can't be there and I need to leave.
Yeah. 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 And that's probably all that would be. And, yeah. So, and I've thought about the same kind of thing myself. It's like, you know, I could be out here overnight. I could be.
Yeah. It's very peaceful. You should just do it at a park that is open overnight.
Yeah.
Although it's not as peaceful because there are more people around. So there's
that. That's true.
That's true.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, Eric, thanks. Thank you. I appreciate it and look forward to running into you out on the trail again.
So. Yeah, this has been delightful. Thank you, brother.
Appreciate it. Thanks for sharing.
All right, take care. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Trail Talk. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. That way you won't miss out on any new episodes. If you'd like to contact me, you can find me on Facebook as @UltramarathonMindset, or you can find me on the web at theultramarathonmindset.com. Remember, your mindset is the key to success in running and in life.
and developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Hey, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time.